FilmSpotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Based on the novel by Irvin Welsh, Filth stars James McAvoy as a corrupt homicide cop. Watch it on demand on April 24th before it's in theaters. And Paulina Garcia stars in Gloria as a free-spirited woman rediscovering love, life, and heartbreak. Available on demand starting on April 29th.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The art house is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And coming up on the show, Matt gets laid off from the podcast.
Wait, what?
And then contemplates returning to the studio.
But I live here.
To take me hostage and his dog Kirby hostage as we review the new Steve Coogan comedy, Alan Partridge.
I really need to start reading these scripts before we say them on the show. Get the intern in here.
I wish we had an actual intern.
Would be really nice. Later in the show, if I'm still here, I guess, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered around a common theme. And in honor of Alan Partridge and Steve Coogan, the star of Alan Partridge, we thought we might take a trip through Northern England, where Allison, a wildly successful critic and podcaster for BuzzFeed, would reluctantly take her frenemy, me, Matt, who is not very bright but has a remarkable gift for impressions, on a food tour of the country's best restaurants. But let's be honest, we don't have the budget for a tour of Northern England's finest restaurants. We don't even have the budget for a tour of Brooklyn's less finer pizza restaurants. So rather than traveling to England, let's just live vicariously through some of the country's best comedies. Before we do that, though, let's do Opening Break, which is a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand. Allison, what's our picks this week?
Well, first up, we have a really interesting film called Blue Ruin, which is available on demand on April 25th. It's written and directed by Jeremy Saulnier, who has also made a film called Murder Party that made the festival rounds a few years ago. He's also a cinematographer. He was a cinematographer for Putty Hill, I Used to Be Darker, among other indie films. And he approaches this story with a really kind of interesting approach to like a more visual form of storytelling. But Blue Ruin is basically a revenge story about a man named Dwight, who is played by Macon Blair, who also was in Murder Party. Dwight, when the film begins, is living out of a car. He's just scrounging for food and apparently is kind of like a wordless vagrant until news comes that someone from his past has gotten out of jail, and it sets him off on a path to revenge. What's interesting about this film as it unfolds is, one, he's not a particularly adept person in terms of either violence or crime in general. And so his first actions on this kind of set off a war between people he knows and this family. But also, it's kind of a story about revenge and how revenge can just kind of cycle over and over again, which is a theme that films have tackled before, but this one makes particularly sad.
I apologize for the mystery. I don't mean to scare you. You're not in any trouble. Everything's fine. You'll be fine. But honey, someone brought this by our stoop, and I just thought you should be somewhere safe when you found out. With somebody. He's going to be released. And I don't know how much you... They are missed. It's an awful thing he did to them. I'm just going to hold you here for a little while.
There's nothing epic about the revenge that is happening here. It just seems kind of self-destructive and like something that no one's able to extricate themselves from. And Macon Blair plays Dwight as a guy who is just scared out of his mind a lot of the time, which, as you know, Matt, is how I like my action heroes to look just terrified. It reminds me a little of Shotgun Stories, And it's one that's worth looking up. And it is available on April 25th. That's Blue Ruin.
Double, second, whatever you want to say to that recommendation. I've seen it. I saw that movie at Fantastic Fest last year. It's really outstanding. If you're a fan of revenge movies, and even if you're not, I mean, I think it's, I think it's
not
just a
traditional. It's not a traditional.
No,
revenge
and
movie,
I think it's,
sense.
I think it's just a very well written, well shot. Macon Blair, the actor,
also,
is fantastic.
Unusually good sound design, I remember. Like, there
yes.
very few few films appreciate...
Sound
how,
of running water in yeah. one scene.
And also how
important.
Inappropriate kind of background music that's playing in a club or on someone's, you know, in someone's car can
yes.
be to how you actually feel.
Yeah, it's really, really good. It's a, you know, it's not a very complicated movie, but it's very well made. Really,
yes.
really recommended.
So there you go. Firm, two thumbs up.
Absolutely.
Except that's trademarked, so
yes.
let's not do that.
Two elbows up.
Yes, from us. That's Blue Ruin. There are two more films that are new to On Demand. I haven't seen either yet. And I will say they both have attracted kind of mixed to negative reviews, but I am very intrigued by the people involved in both of these. The first one is Gambit, which is available on demand on April 25th. This is a remake of the 1966 kind of comedy heist film that starred Shirley MacLaine and Michael Caine. This one is directed by Michael Hoffman and stars Colin Firth, Cameron Diaz, Alan Rickman, and Stanley Tucci. It opened in the UK in November 2012. Never a good sign when a film has that kind of cast and sits around for 2 years before eventually coming out. The UK reception was not very good. However, this film is scripted by Joel and Ethan Coen,
yeah.
which is really intriguing to me. I think even if it's not a successful remake, I really do want to see what they've done with this film. So it's one I'm going to check out, just at least as a Coen completist. That's Gambit. It's available on April 25th. And on April 29th is Black Nativity. This is a musical directed by Casey Lemons. You may remember her film Eve's Bayou, which was a terrific film. Also one that was really championed by Roger Ebert. But this is based on the Langston Hughes play of the same name. It came out around the holidays last year and stars an ensemble cast that includes Forest Whitaker, Angela Bassett, Tyrese Gibson, Jennifer Hudson, Mary J. Blige, Vondi Curtis Hall, and Nas. So... quite a cast there, and I think that just the prospect of seeing all of them together is very interesting to me. So that is Black Nativity, available April 29th.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory. On Wednesday I go shopping and have buttered scones for tea.
He cuts down trees, he eats his lunch, he goes to the lavatory. On Wednesday he goes shopping and has buttered scones for tea. He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I skip and jump. I like to press wildflowers. I put on women's clothing and hang around in bars.
He cuts down trees, he skips and jumps. He likes to press wildflowers. He puts on women's clothing and hangs around in bars. He's a lumberjack and he's okay.
All right, our topic this week for our Q Shots, British comedy, which is one of the broader categories we've done on the show. So it's going to be tough to make some generalizations, but let's try anyway, Allison. Why not? No, do you consider yourself a fan? Like, for some people, I think the phrase British comedy is enough to get them in the door. You know, like a TV show. This was a popular British comedy. That's enough to get some people to, you know, queue it up to watch it on to stream it or maybe even to rent the movie if it's a movie. Is it enough for you?
No, I mean, no. I like British comedies, some of them.
You need more.
But yeah, I feel like as a category unto itself, it doesn't have like an instinctive appeal that I feel like there's a real fandom, in the U.S. of people who would describe themselves as British comedy geeks.
Right.
And I just don't qualify.
Right. Well, I think to some degree for those people, the people who would self-identify, it's probably has something to do with the exclusivity of it. You know, like the same reason that somebody 20 years ago, though not now, might be into like comic books or something that, you know, it's like an inherently here. It's an inherently cult object because they're usually hard to find, even though now you can find them more on certain cable stations. Hulu is actually a place that a lot of British series that have never been picked up for television in the States have kind of found a home. So it's a little easier now. Maybe it's less appealing to some of these people now. But I think that there's a certain kind of person where that is part of the appeal, is the difficulty. You know, it proves your dedication that you had to, you know, when back in the day, I remember going to even like, you know, comic book conventions and seeing British TV shows that had never been released officially in the United States. You would see them on vendors' tables, guys who sold like bootleg movies and TV shows. They would have, you know, bootlegs of this, you know, TV show or this movie that had never come out here. It's almost like a offshoot of that kind of culture in a certain way, that it's sort of this like obscure, you know, kind of unknown, strange thing. And I wonder if the opposite is the case for some people, although probably not, because Americans just export their culture in an obnoxious and over the top way. So
yeah,
maybe not.
I did an interview once with last year with the now outgoing person who was in charge of original programming and acquiring international television for Hulu.
Okay.
And she said that when I was talking to her about, oh, do you think that people are more receptive to watching subtitled television now? Which is something that you never, you know, like even at least British comedy had certain inns, and British television in general, PBS, you know, and then
right.
BBC America, and then other networks.
Sometimes on HBO.
Yeah. But it was far rarer to see something from another country
sure.
that might require subtitles. And she said, yes. And then she also said, you know, in every other country, like sometimes these things will turn up dubbed, but oftentimes they'll also be just subtitled on television.
Right.
We, like, America has a particular weird privilege of assuming that
we're snobs.
Yes.
Subtitle snobs.
Our popular culture gets exported, but that we don't import a lot of
right.
popular culture. We're just not like curious about it, or
ours is pretty good.
Yeah.
Ours is the best.
Good
America.
Yeah. I don't know what else they've got out there, but ours
nothing's
is probably
gonna be better than Dance Moms. No way.
And so instead we get remakes of them, right?
Right.
Yes.
Put some people I recognize in it.
Exactly.
Have them speak my language, then maybe I'll think about it. Until
exactly.
then, Dance Moms.
Exactly. But I do appreciate that there's more availability. I mean, I love being able to see international television and British television
right.
particularly on Netflix, on Hulu.
Right.
It may not make the club as
exclusive and cool.
And yeah, and as difficult to belong to as it used to be. But
yes.
it's nice to be able to see these things and to, you know, enjoy them.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I guess that's a good segue into my first pick, because it's a show. It's a British comedy series, which I remember when it came out, or when it first kind of appeared in the United States, which was a year or two after it had already been on the BBC, I believe. It wasn't that easy to track down, and at the time you had to watch it on DVD. And I can remember, I don't even know who had the DVD, but it became a thing where it's like, have you seen it? Have you seen it? And this is when I was in grad school, trading, like handing the DVD around. One person had a copy, maybe even a multi-region copy from the UK. And we passed it around, and then the show became a little more famous. And it came out in the United States on DVD, came easier to see. But I can remember following it, sort of the news. We were sort of behind the news of it. The show would air, and then a year later, you might see the series of it, right? And now you can watch the show on Netflix, the entire thing. It's called The Office, which, again,
I've heard of it.
Yes, which again is one of these shows where it wasn't even had to be subtitled, but was remade in America and proved hugely popular. And I think probably for most of our listeners, they've probably seen some of the American Office. I'm not sure, though, at this point, how many have seen the British Office. I mean, I think it's a fairly well-known thing. And like I said, in my peer group, like right around that grad school period, everyone was watching it. We all thought this was the most brilliant show ever. But I don't know. So if you haven't seen it, it is on Netflix. And I just watched a little bit of it last night to see how it holds up. And my God, it is still such a funny show. And I was sitting there quoting it and laughing at it. And I don't really – I mean, the thing that I really was thinking when I was looking at it is you know, how at the time it did feel kind of revolutionary because it had this, you know, Spinal Tap mockumentary kind of structure, which at the, you know, at least at, in early 2000s seemed pretty novel, and now has become almost the standard, more than you know, the standard two camera or three camera, you know.
It's a type, it's a way you shoot a sitcom.
Right. And when it was made, it seemed, you know, the fact that it was one camera and it was aping a documentary style and it didn't have a laugh track seemed so, you know, foreign. Even though they were speaking in English, it just seemed so crazy. And it is kind of hard to believe in retrospect that it became a huge hit in America, because it was so unique. And also, the thing that really struck me looking at it again was that main guy, you know, David Brent, Ricky Gervais, how wonderfully unlikable he is, you know? And over time, they did kind of humanize him. I can remember by really, like, so the series was two seasons, brief seasons, and then, like, a final special, like a two-part special to wrap up the series. And by the end of those specials, they've kind of humanized him to a degree where he's gotten so pathetic that you kind of feel bad for him. But, God, he is such a creep in those, in a lot of the show, and especially those first couple episodes, in a way that I feel like even now you almost can't get away with in a lot of TV shows, at least in comedies.
Yeah. What's that? Popcorn, Ben Elton. Funny?
It's all right, yeah.
Had a bit of a scare earlier.
You do?
I thought I found a lump. I mean, I examine myself regularly, but it's fine. But terrifying. Testicular cancer. Cancer of them old testicles. What's that?
It's a bit of brie.
What, from down there?
Yeah.
See you later.
I don't know. You're a bigger expert on TV than I am, Allison. I really want to give this show a lot of credit for the, you know, the impact it had in a formal sense in terms of the look of television. But is Ricky Gervais, is David Brent one of the anti-heroes? People talk about the age of anti-heroes on television now with The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and all these shows. And does David Brent count? I mean, he's kind of an anti-hero. He's a horrible person.
Yeah, it's hard to say because I feel like that character in comedy is something kind of is different, something different. But certainly a lot of contemporary comedy from Girls, or like Girls or Veep, say, mm-hmm. like those both have characters that are deliberately often very selfish and like very self-involved,
narcissistic and vain,
exactly,
but also like not really deserving of, you know, like completely misplaced narcissism. That's really the hallmark.
Exactly, yeah.
And something that I think Alan Partridge has in common with this character as well.
And I would say, I do wonder if there's something that's not uniquely British, but it seems like that to kind of have origins there, at least I tend to associate, especially with Ricky Gervais, who very few people allow themselves to be as obnoxious and just awful and off-putting as he is in that show and in other shows.
In Extras.
Life's Too Short and a lot of these series are just, the comedy is agonizing. And I do find that with The Office, as much as I admire it, I want to watch it with my hands over my eyes. It's just, I find it kind of excruciating as well as it's funny.
But that too, I think that's another way in which this show really was a trailblazer, because I think that's another thing that's sort of become a very in vogue style of comedy, is that like comedy of humiliation. I mean,
yes. It's interesting to me. Ricky Gervais has his public persona also plays into that a lot. I don't know, even following him on Twitter, where he spends a lot of the day just like baiting religious people. Just like, is that your hobby, Ricky Gervais? You're like this famous.
Right.
I find how The Office was translated to the U.S. an interesting thing unto itself as well.
Well, they tried to do like the exact duplicates, which is something that's been done before very unsuccessfully. And I remember watching the first season because I was such a huge fan, and going, boy, this really doesn't get it. It's, you know, it's not quite the same thing. And I stopped watching it, and then it slowly became its own show and became a huge hit, which was very surprising to watch from a distance. And I haven't really gone back. I think I've seen only the first two seasons of the American Office. But I still hold that British show very, very close to my heart. And if you haven't seen it, even if you've seen the American version and you feel like that's a, you know, that's enough, go check out that British show. There, it has some amazing, amazing episodes. And really, there's no bad ones in there either. It's a short series. You can binge it pretty quickly. That's The Office, the UK Office, available on Netflix.
All right. For my first pick, I also chose a series and its spin-off film. And I would say it also plays a bit into that comedy of just humiliation and embarrassment, except in a quieter way, because this is politics after all. The Thick of It, which is currently streaming on Hulu. You can stream the whole series. I don't think they're making any more. And so it's all there. And then In the Loop, which is the film that was made afterwards on Netflix, both from Armando Iannucci, who has gone on to make Veep at HBO, which is very similar in terms of that documentary style. Just kind of shot on the fly, looking very loose, no laugh track, some improv. And The Thick of It is a comedy that's set in the Department of Social Affairs and Citizenship, which is a fictional department in the British government, and is basically about both of these are, and I something that I think Armando Iannucci does so well and gets is so funny is that for all of that, these are, you know, places in the government and places of power, they are also workplaces, and they are filled with the same kind of petty rivalries and insecurities.
It's The Office. It really is the office in British government.
Right, except the stakes are theoretically higher,
right,
though you don't often see them.
The people, though, don't treat the stakes any higher.
No,
which is
because everyone is like so concerned about getting left out of the meeting or not getting the right interview or looking bad. You know, and will do things that are not for the greater good in any way, just to protect their own egos.
Exactly.
And I think Iannucci is kind of brilliant at it. And, you know, his great creation is Malcolm Tucker, the character played by Peter Capaldi, who is, I don't remember his exact title, but basically he's kind of the director of communications, I believe, and the enforcer, and also is the person who gets the bulk of the profanity in extremely creative ways. And Peter Capaldi, often the new Doctor Who, on Doctor Who, Peter Capaldi often looks like he's about to, you know, have an aneurysm when he's like in fury with his eyes bulging, delivering these like spitting lines at people. None of which I will quote on this podcast because they are all inappropriate. And also I just can't get the rhythms down quite like he does. You know, he's got to do it. But this series, actually, speaking of like kind of availability, the series screened on BBC America and they bleeped it, which just seems to eliminate the entire point of just a lot of the dialogue. When Hulu picked it up, and they actually, I think, co-produced the last season, they put it all up, profanities and all. But In the Loop is the 2009 film that Armando Iannucci brought to Sundance, which involves some of the characters, mainly Malcolm Tucker, from the series, and then crossing over into the US. And on that topic of like people being extremely petty over these rather large stakes, this is basically about how everyone accidentally agrees to a war,
right?
Based on one minister's accidentally saying that a war in the Middle East is unforeseeable. And then all of the kind of manipulations and politics that go around that. It is extremely funny. And I really recommend it. You don't need to have seen The Thick of It to enjoy In the Loop, though I think they go very well together. But the In the Loop has, in addition to Peter Capaldi and some other actors, Anna Chlumsky, who is now in Veep, and the late, great James Gandolfini, who is really funny in this, and you don't always get to see him in comedies, and he is great in the Loop.
Yeah. Secretary Linton Barrick asked me to let you know that his last meeting looks like it's overrunning. Sends his apologies.
When will he be here?
I don't have that information at this moment.
What the f***? Huh?
I apologize.
Did he stand me up?
No, sir. You're more than welcome to wait.
You know what I'm going to do, son? No. I'm going to take a nice big shit on his desk just to let him know that I was here. Is that okay with you?
I don't think he'd like that too much, sir.
So that's The Thick of It on Hulu and In the Loop, which is currently streaming on Netflix.
And Armando Iannucci, also one of the writers and producers of Alan Partridge again.
There you go.
One of the guys who helped create the character and was involved with him for years and years. So not too shabby, that guy. He's pretty talented.
He's doing all right.
He's doing okay. Yeah, he's not bad. My next pick is actually a film series, and it's one that I'm going to just confess right off the bat. I'm not an expert on, but fascinated by and sampled last night and kind of really interested in and would love to have the time to really look into the whole thing. It's this film series from the 50s through the 90s, although I think most of the confined to the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's a series called Carry On. Have you ever seen any of these movies?
I've seen a lot of these
when I
was at my grandparents' house in England.
Well,
yes.
you're British, your British grandparents, you have a leg up on me in this category. I was reading about it and then watching a little of them to get a sense of them for this podcast, you know, it struck me watching them that, you know, like, we've talked about The Office and In the Loop, and there's that sort of like that strain of kind of cool British comedy that, as we said, like, it can kind of be the cool kid thing to watch, is like, oh, I'm into Monty Python. Oh, I was watching Fawlty Towers. You know, like these things where, as Americans, you know, they're very hip to like. And then there's sort of like the opposite end of the spectrum where instead of it being sort of very witty and kind of very intelligent, it can also be kind of, British comedy can also be very lowbrow.
Benny Hill.
That's exactly where I'm going.
Yep.
Benny Hill, Mr. Bean, you know, the Rowan Atkinson, very physical stuff, which I actually love.
Yeah.
I mean, as a kid, I loved Mr. Bean. I used to watch Benny Hill on PBS and channels like that. Mr. Bean, I used to watch all the time. And I watching the Carry On series, it kind of felt like something that was in that same vein, just very lowbrow, kind of bawdy, kind of physical comedy. It almost reminded me also of like Mel Brooks' kind of Zucker Brothers style stuff, because it's basically this 31 film series between 58 and 92, mostly produced by Peter Rogers, directed by Gerald Thomas, and with the same troupe of actors appearing in movie after movie. And I say they're sort of like Mel Brooks movies or Airplane because each one kind of spoofs a different topic, a different genre, or a different aspect of British culture. All with Carry On as the first two words of the title. So Carry On Up the Jungle, Carry On Doctor, Carry On Cowboy. The one that I watched last night is Carry On Cleo from 1964. That's available for free on Amazon Prime. Any guess what that one's about, Allison? Carry On Cleo?
Cleo? I give up.
It's a spoof of Cleopatra. Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra came out in 1963, so the year after they cashed in on it with Carry On Cleo from 1964. So there's a bunch that are on Amazon Prime for free. Carry On Cleo, Carry On Cruising, Carry On Cowboy, Carry On Jack. But then if you really want to go really deep into this thing, there's like a dozen more at least that are on Amazon, which you could rent, which you could pay for, including Carry On Up the Khyber, Carry On Up the Jungle, Carry On Matron, Carry On Girls, which I'm sure was a huge influence on Lena Dunham, I'm guessing. Carry On England, Carry On At Your Convenience, and my personal favorite of all the titles I've seen, Carry On Follow That Camel.
And I warn you, members of the Senate, if we allow Caesar to go on like this, the Roman Empire's finished.
Yeah.
Already, gentlemen, we are in a decline, and I don't have to remind you what that leads to. A fall.
I'm so sorry. Did I interrupt something?
Hail Caesar.
Likewise, I'm sure.
So, I mean, there's not much for me to say other than I watched one of them last night and I laughed. I mean, it's pretty silly, pretty lowbrow. You know, you kind of, it's that sort of comedy. Again, closer to a Mel Brooks than a Monty Python or something a little, or The Office, certainly. But I'm fascinated because, you know, I'd only heard about the series because I had a friend in grad school who's, again, that grad school thing, people watching British comedy in grad school. He was, for some reason, I never really understood why, he like found these movies and just started watching all of them. He was renting them one after the other from the video store on tape, I think, back then. But I never watched any of them with him, and I've never seen any of them until last night. And it's fascinating that the series, I think it's the most, the British series, film series with the most entries in history, even more than Bond. You know, it's like 31 to 23, I guess, at this point for Bond. But just hugely successful for decades and basically completely unknown in the U.S., but it is available. That's the thing. You could check it out. So if you're in the mood for something silly, not too serious, the one I watched was Carry On Cleo. And again, there's a whole bunch available on Amazon Prime and even more that you can rent just for rent on Amazon.
All right. For my second pick, I'm also picking an older comedy. It is available for rent on iTunes. And I only just saw this for the first time recently, and I'm really glad I did. It's Kind Hearts and Coronets, the 1949 comedy, an Ealing comedy, directed by Robert Hammer and featuring Alec Guinness in 8 roles alongside Dennis Price and Valerie Hobson and Joan Greenwood. And it's basically an extremely polite film about murder. It's Dennis Price plays Louis Mazzini, who is a poor relation to this aristocratic family, basically because his mother married an opera singer, married for love. She was cast out of the family, so he's far on down the line to be the Duke. And he decides, after his mother dies and he has to bury her in a tacky suburban grave, he decides, he swears revenge, and he's going to murder his way up to being the Duke. And he does this quite methodically and really quite elegantly. It's there's just a humor in the way he approaches, say, tracking down one of his relatives as he's off with his mistress boating and arranging for them to get swept over a waterfall or cliff. And another one who is a parson who he poisons while he's getting trashed. And every time he slowly moves up and seems not at all bothered by the fact that he is murdering his way into the aristocracy. The character gets some great, just like some wonderful lines that are kind of underdeliver what he's talking about. In the case of the parson, he says, the Reverend Lord Henry was not one of those newfangled parsons who carry the principles of their vocation uncomfortably into private life. And the fact that Guinness plays basically the entire family that is murdered, including one female character, makes it all the funnier and also, you know, blunts a little bit of the idea of what this guy is doing. Given that all of these characters are ridiculous in their own way, they're all stuffy for the most part. They're all incredibly buried in their own relative niches, whether that be the Navy or, just in general aristocracy, or, you know, for the Reverends, his kind of like religious life. They're all completely oblivious, and in a lot of ways, you definitely root for him as he goes along, but they're just these kind of intolerable old fossils, so you kind of feel like he deserves to be the Duke, even, at least he's going to enjoy it more.
The more I thought of them, these people whom I had studied until I knew their names and histories as well as I knew my own, the more they became monsters of arrogance and cruelty, whose only function in the world was to deprive me of my birthright. I had seen Chalfont only as Mama had painted it. To pass in through that magnificent gateway on visitor's day at a cost of sixpence was a humiliating experience, but I forced myself to undergo it. I wanted a closer view of the target at which I had determined to aim.
So it's a terrific film, and just one that, I don't know, has like such a kind of like great silky center performance in terms of a comedy anti-hero who is just one you really want to see succeed. And there's a nice frame story as well, in which he is, when the film begins, he's going to be executed for murder. So these are all his memoirs as he writes down his grand life story, which is certainly worth taking in. That's Kind Hearts and Coronets, which is available for rent on iTunes.
Okay, now, are you on any medication?
Just some cream. I've got very aggressive athlete's foot, but that's the only thing about me that is.
And do you suffer from any nervous conditions, such as panic attacks?
Do I look like I suffer from panic attacks? I've had one panic attack in a car wash. It was a perfect storm of no sleep, no wife, and angry brushes whirring towards me. By the time the giant hairdryer came on, I was in the footwell.
Does the idea of weaponry trouble you?
No. I've fired several rifles at funfairs and won prizes. But I've never fired one in anger or at a cat.
All right, it's time for our listener's choice review, chosen by you, the listeners, when you email us or vote at filmspottingsvu.com. On our last episode, we gave you three options from recent films that were just added for rental around the web. The found footage vampire movie Afflicted, the Steve Coogan comedy Alan Partridge, and the Keanu Reeves train wreck 47 Ronin. And frankly, Allison, I thought, because we have so many listeners who email us telling us how much they love bad movies, recommending bad movies to us, I thought we would be stuck watching 47 Ronin.
I was excited to watch 47 Ronin.
I was a little excited, too, but it didn't happen. Alan Partridge was the winner with 38% of the vote. The film, directed by Declan Lowney, follows Coogan's self-absorbed radio DJ, Alan Partridge, who is fighting to keep his job after his station is bought out by a massive media conglomerate. And faced with the realization that his new bosses are considering firing either him or his fellow jock, Pat Farrell, played by Star Trek Deep Space Nine's Cole Meany, he sells his coworker out without hesitation. And this becomes an issue after the new management fires Pat, and then Pat basically goes postal. He returns to the radio station at a party with a shotgun. So in the United States, this film has been released under the simple title of Alan Partridge, but in the UK, it's known as Alan Partridge Alpha Papa, because while this is the character's first movie, Steve Coogan has actually been playing Alan Partridge on TV and on radio for more than two decades. So my questions to you, Allison, are: how much of Steve Coogan's earlier Alan Partridge work have you seen? And either how does this film compare to it? How does it rate with it? Or if you haven't seen any of it, how does this movie stand alone and work for you as a Partridge newbie?
That's an interesting question. I have seen some of, and now I'm trying to remember what the context was, but some of the talk show he did.
Knowing you.
Yeah. Yes. I've seen a few episodes of that, which I liked a lot.
Okay.
I thought it was just so, yes, clever, basically. And I think that's my main exposure to Alan Partridge. I thought that I really love the character. I think it just kind of plays into Steve Coogan's strengths in general, which is this kind of oblivious vanity. And beneath it, this tragic sense of slight self-awareness that things are always kind of getting away from you and they are always getting a little left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the character really epitomizes those two so well. The Knowing Me, Knowing You, from what I remember, was a lot less of the latter quality. And I thought the film certainly played more into that. You know, at this point in Partridge's career, he's been demoted from TV personality to this kind of lesser radio jockey on the station where they're skewing younger. They're trying to skew younger. And, you know, the reason that those two are up for getting fired is because they both have the oldest audience and are doing the most old school kind of radio.
Right.
And that sadness of just understanding that your time is passing and that no one's interested in what you're doing anymore is certainly underlying this in a way that I liked. It did feel more, a little bigger and maybe a little softer than the show does, mm-hmm, to me, but it didn't bother me too much. I think like what I liked best was how it ended when it kind of got to the conclusions. Mm-hmm. Like I thought that was great. Mm. But what about you? I'd ask you the same question.
Well, I think I've seen a little bit of the I'm Alan Partridge, which was like the sitcom that came after that talk show. Just a little bit. Again, around that grad school period or when I was working at a video store just after that. And we had, again, like some bootlegs. I don't think they were available at the time in the U.S. And I just took some of the bootlegs out. I don't really remember much about them. So I fairly Alan Partridge newbie. And I actually really enjoyed the film and felt that you didn't have to know anything about the character to enjoy the movie. I think the movie does a very admirable job of standing alone. And, you know, they did give it the subtitle in the UK. But, you know, you could just call it Alan Partridge. And if you didn't know, you might not know that the character has this long backstory. And you wouldn't be longing to see these other things. And I give it some credit for that. There, you know, we just had the Veronica Mars movie come out in the U.S. just a month or two ago. And that was a show that I hadn't watched either. But I watched the movie. And I could appreciate to a certain extent that, you know, like the movie exists and the fans made it happen and it was made for the fans. And I think to a certain extent, that's fantastic. You know, like the movie doesn't need to be made for me. I didn't watch the show. I don't need to really see the movie. I really watched it more out of professional curiosity than anything else. But I was impressed with the way that this movie was, you know, you didn't have to know anything about the character and you could completely enjoy this. And I was looking afterwards and I didn't even realize like some of these characters are from the sitcom. Some of them aren't. And it's, you can't really tell. In the Veronica Mars movie, on the other hand, it was pretty obvious who was an older character and also the, you know, just how much of it was, you know, fan service and recurring jokes and bringing stuff back. And I'm sure there's stuff in here that are recurring jokes or callbacks that I don't get. But I was laughing so much that I didn't really bother me at all, actually. And I thought it was really funny. And I agree with you also that it touches on a lot of that stuff that I love so much about some of those other Steve Coogan movies that I've seen with Michael Winterbottom, particularly The Trip, which I guess is also a TV show, too. It's complicated. But, I mean, a lot of those movies or shows, what's so good about them is the melancholy that goes into that Coogan character of this guy. I mean, they're always very much about this guy who's getting older, who's not happy how his career is going or who feels his career slipping away. And even though Alan is a kind of more ridiculous character and less kind of overtly sad, there's this very clear sort of subtext of desperation to everything he does, which I think really only enhances the comedy because it comes from this very kind of personal place. So I like that about it a lot. I was a little wary. Maybe because of the Veronica Mars movie, but I like this a lot. I would recommend it. And again, I would recommend it to anyone who's just looking for a good comedy. You don't have to be an Alan Partridge fan to enjoy it.
Yeah. I think that it also, I was more wary of the idea of it as a hostage situation, which I feel has been done kind of.
Well, this exact movie has been done. I don't know if you remember the movie Airheads.
I've never seen Airheads.
Oh, you're a lucky woman. I mean, this is really one of the dregs of sort of the mid-90s, you know, comedies. I remember this movie must have been on HBO 600,000 times when we were growing up. And I would watch as much of it as I could stand because apparently I was just that lonely and bored of a child that I had nothing better to do. This was before Netflix and before Hulu and before DVR, remember?
Before the on-demand lifestyle.
Right. You kind of had to watch what they were giving you. So Airheads was about a band. The band members were played by Brendan Fraser, Adam Sandler, and Steve Buscemi.
I can kind of remember the VHS. Like,
yeah. The three of them on the cover, right? And they hold a radio station hostage to get their music played on the air. I think the DJ is Joe Mantegna, and the evil station manager character is Michael McKean. So it's slightly different in that it's not like a employee or former employee of the radio station, but it's basically the same thing. And like, you know, a hostage situation forms, the cops show up, the crowds gather around, and people, you know, the people become media celebrities as a result. It's very similar. The difference is Airheads is a terrible movie. And actually, as I sort of fully grasped where this movie was going, I was like, oh no, this is Airheads. And I was really worried about that. And I have to give Alan Partridge a huge amount of credit for kind of making that topic funny. I mean, hostage situations can also be kind of dark. That's the other thing is like, I think for some reason that's something that people think can be funny. And it so rarely is because it can get very dark. I mean, there's some jokes in this about one of the poor employees, Cole Meany gives him this like duct tape helmet
with a handle
for his shotgun, which is so dark. And like there's this whole segment where they're doing this kind of on air repartee, Alan Partridge and the Cole Meany character. And I think Coogan says something like, you forget that the gun is even there after a while. And the guy who's got the gun to his head is like, no, you don't.
Well, I think also that what I love about this is in terms of what it did with the hostage situation is that, you know, with something like Airheads, I'm assuming there's this triumphant moment of being like, and our music got out there and all of that. And really what Steve Coogan's character, Alan Partridge, is trying to hold on to is just a terrible form of talk radio, you know, like where people call in and just say, like, I don't like it when people park outside my house. And like, you know, and then he plays like some easy listening rock or something. And plays, you know, like there's not any integrity to begin with.
Right. And what's also great, too, is that he is so desperate for any sort of attention that he has no vested interest in ending the hostage situation. He's actually wants it to keep going because it keeps his name on national television again. He's suddenly relevant again.
Yeah.
So you have the guy who is ostensibly the go-between between the hostage taker and the police is like actively working against, you know, the solution, the resolution of the problem, because that's what's best for him. And I loved how, you know, again, getting back to sort of the David Brent thing, it's like, how many movies do we get to see where the hero is not a hero at all? It's just spineless and selfish and narcissistic and vain and doesn't really learn much over the course of the movie. I love that about this because we get spoon-fed so many traditional characters with traditional arcs, the hero's journey, and that can be satisfying when it's done well. But I found it very refreshing to meet this character who is, he's kind of likable in his, because he's so sad and pathetic, but is a jerk. He's narcissistic. He is self-obsessed. He sells out his friend.
Immediately.
With no hesitation. Yes. As I said in the intro, he completely sells this guy out who thinks he's his friend and does some horrible things in this movie. And the movie is not about his redemption. And thank God for that, because the movie that, you know, a movie about the redemption of Alan Partridge would have been horrible. And I really enjoyed that this movie, with very few exceptions, does not try to make him into a good guy.
Yeah. You know, and Alan Partridge, he's what, in his 50s, I think. He's not going to change that much. He is who he is.
Right.
At this point, you know.
Can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Yeah. Like he changes maybe a little bit with regard to like where he ends up.
Sure.
But even that.
And a little bit is fine.
That's enough. That's as much as you can hope for, really.
Right.
In a realistic world, people change maybe a little bit, and that's good. That it does. It also, Steve Coogan gets in a lot of great bits of physical humor here. It's not directly related to him, but the whole thing about the handle, the kind of just like, it's a great visual bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole other part where he tries to get back in the building, which is amazing.
Yep, that's a great
just
sequence.
The whole sequence of how it happens and the very idea that he needs to break back into the building with the hostages.
Yeah, Coogan, he's a well-rounded guy. I don't think he gets to show off enough of that physical side in you know, the Winterbottom movies, which are a little more kind of, you know, intellectual and
verbal.
And verbal, exactly. And a lot of people sitting around at tables over, you know, food, discussing things and doing impressions, which are fantastic. But yeah, you really get to appreciate how well-rounded of a comedian he is. He's, you know, he's got these great verbal skills, but he can also do a pratfall with surprising dexterity and lack of shame, which are both very important when you're doing pratfalls.
It's an amazing lack of shame, really.
And it's also a quotable movie, too. I mean, I feel like this is a movie, if this had come out when I was in high school, if this was playing on HBO 100 times instead of Airheads, I would have watched this movie over and over again and just ate it up and started quoting it and doing Alan Partridge and having a grand old time. It kind of reminded me, actually, of some of those movies from that period, almost like a Saturday Night Live movie, you know, where you take a character who's got this kind of existing persona, and you could tell Coogan just innately just is in this guy. He just gets it. He knows how to do it in his sleep. He could do it. And put that character in a slightly bigger situation. You know, it's a hostage situation, all that stuff. But basically, it's about giving this character a bigger showcase and kind of doing some of the stuff maybe you couldn't do on a smaller scale, on a budget, on a TV show, because they just didn't have the time or the resources.
Yeah.
And you get it to do them here. But it's still really quotable and very, very watchable.
So give me a line. What is your favorite?
Oh, don't put me on a spot.
Right.
Yeah, I don't.
I liked when
I'm trying to not do any bad impressions on this episode.
I did like when there's like one, just like a random one-off, when a police officer is like, identify yourself. And he's kind of angry that he's like, I'm Alan Partridge, you know, I haven't been off the television for that long. Like, identify yourself, which is a particular, just like kind of typical misread of all the situation.
I think the one that I liked the most that I could see myself quoting would be the one where he's talking to someone and he makes a terrible joke and she just doesn't respond. And he says something like, I'm just joking. Enjoy me. Which is really a very applicable phrase to my life because I make a lot of terrible jokes that no one laughs at. And I can just see myself when someone doesn't laugh the next time just saying, enjoy me.
I feel like I relate more to when he always goes like, happy times. And then the person finishes their anecdote by saying like, you know, right. Scatter my dad's ashes or
right.
Something.
Yeah, that's a very office thing where he puts his foot in his mouth quite a bit. Always to a pretty good comedic effect.
Yeah, I will say Bullseye, it's another podcast with Jesse Thorne, that they recently did an interview with Steve Coogan where he talked a bit about how as he got older, he had less interest in maybe the kind of sarcasm or the kind of more cynical humor that he kind of attributed to things that you're very interested in when you're coming up, which I would say, and certainly he is as well. That's defined a lot of those early. I mean, Alan Partridge is in a way the story of this, which is that he said as he worked on, like, part of his reason for wanting to work on Philomena, which he wrote and starred in, is his desire to make something sincere. And right. I think that this, maybe the story of Alan Partridge is from going to perhaps starting at this more kind of easier target or like crueler sense of humor. And then as it goes along, this character becoming more and more human, you know, to the point where now with this movie, he's still a ridiculous character and he's still oblivious and narcissistic and desperate, but he is also deeply human. You know, he is a very fleshed out character. He's not just a kind of parody of this empty, bloviating newscaster. You know, he's someone who's had a full arc and at this point in his life is getting older and really struggling to hold on to his idea of who he is. And I think that the film does capture that very well. And yet still with a great laugh.
Absolutely. So that is Alan Partridge, and seems like we both, two elbows up, I guess, we both enjoyed it quite a bit. And that one is available for rent on Amazon and iTunes and a variety of other services and outlets. All right, let's wrap things up with our Behind the 8-Ball segment. You know how it goes. We give you three new titles on streaming, two listener recommendations. And then we also give you one film chosen blindly by number from our My Lists on Netflix. Allison, you're going first on this episode. Are you ready with your new titles?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, what are you waiting for? Just get started already.
Fine, I will. All right. Three new titles. First off is The Great Beauty. This is available on Hulu Plus. It's this year's foreign language film Oscar winner from Paolo Sorrentino, about an aging socialite who once wrote a famous novel, only to retire to a cushy, decadent life in Rome. And he walks through the city after his 65th birthday party and, you know, takes in the cinematic decadence and beauty that is Rome, while reflecting on his life. And that's through Criterion, by the way, who renewed their contract with Hulu. So
huzzah.
Yes. If you were ever kind of wondering if you should pony up for the Hulu Plus fee, that might help you make that decision. Also new to streaming on Hulu, not Hulu Plus, is Meek's Cutoff. This is Kelly Reichardt's 2010 Western. She's a new film out, Night Moves, which is currently playing at the Tribeca Film Festival. This is her last one, loosely based on something that happened on the Oregon Trail in the 1800s, in which a guide by the name of Stephen Meek led a wagon train off into the Oregon desert. Not a great place to be, as you will see in the film, which stars Bruce Greenwood and Michelle Williams. But it's an unusual Western that kind of makes you rethink a lot of the typical tropes of the genre. And new to Netflix is Time to Leave. This is the 2005 film from Francois Ozon, starring Melville Poupeau as a fashion photographer who's in his 30s, gay, leading this fairly fabulous life when he finds out he's terminally ill and only has 3 months to live. And it's about his how he spends his last few months. And it's a beautiful film, but it also doesn't follow any of the kind of typical life-affirming beats that you might expect. It's something very unique and individual about what he does, and it's not always very nice. He kind of prods at people and destroys his relationship. It's a really interesting and gorgeously made film. It's Time to Leave. It is new on Netflix.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
Okay, the first one is from Theo, who writes, "Hey, Matt and Allison, longtime listener and first-time recommender, Theo here, with a romantic comedy called The 5-Year Engagement, which is streaming on Hitlist and available for rental everywhere else. I recommend it because it's one of only 15 romantic comedies I can stomach, and on top of that, it's a great, witty, charming, cute, and above all, laugh-out-loud funny film. It stars Jason Segel and Emily Blunt as a couple who get engaged and then, as the title suggests, let life get in the way of the altar. The supporting cast is stacked with now-famous actors like Chris Pratt, Alison Brie, Chris Parnell, Kevin Hart, as well as Jackie Weaver and Ree Sifans. The film was penned by Siegel and Nicholas Stoller and directed by Stoller, who has also done such hilarious movies as Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Get Him to the Greek, and the two Muppet reboots. Check it out. You won't be disappointed." So that is The 5-Year Engagement, available for rent everywhere and streaming on Hitlist. And second recommendation is from Phil, who writes, "I noticed a recent French treat has appeared on Netflix in the UK. It's also on Netflix in the US. It's a film from Régis Ronsard, a delightful little comedy called Populaire. It looks rather like Mad Men, but is really rather different, as it's about international typing competitions. I really enjoyed this when it came out last year and look forward to revisiting it now that it's available to stream. It has Romain Duris in the lead role, which should be enough to get any fan of French cinema watching."
Okay, how about your one film from your my list?
You gave me number 19, which is Midnight Express, Alan Parker's 1978 film about an American student sent to Turkish prison for trying to smuggle hash. Cautionary tale, don't smuggle hash out of Turkey. Doesn't work out well. Never seen it.
Well, you've already learned the lesson, so why do you have to see it?
I guess just to see how bad it gets. That's what I want to know. I need to be scared straight. All right, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, three new picks.
All right, first up, my favorite film of 2013, Short Term 12. It's finally available on Netflix, and this is the film from writer-director Destin Cretton. It takes place in a foster home for troubled teens. Based on his experiences working in a facility like this, it's a fabulous film. I think I've plugged it at least 300 times on the podcast to date. I loved the movie when I saw it for the first time right before South by Southwest last year. So that's now about 15 months or so that I've been talking about it. Hopefully this will be the last time. Now you have no excuse because it's streaming on Netflix. Please go watch it so I can finally stop bringing it up.
Yeah, I second this recommendation, though. It's really great.
It's an excellent, excellent film. Next up, available on Hulu Plus, is an excellent dance film. It's from Jody Lee Lipes. Actually, his latest dance film, I should say, is playing this week at Tribeca, which, Allison, you're in the middle of covering.
I am.
Have you gotten to see it yet?
Yes, I have seen it.
Is it good?
It is good. It's I'll just mention this briefly. It's a film about a dancer and choreographer at the New York Ballet and it shows his process as he makes a new dance, which is never something
Documentary.
Okay. Never something I'd thought about. It's really fascinating and just as a look at the creative process in dance particularly.
Okay, that's called Ballet 422.
Yes.
And that's premiering at Tribeca, so that'll be coming to you in some form, in some way down the road. But this film, which is available now on Hulu Plus, is his previous dance film, which was co-directed actually by Henry Joost, who was one of the co-directors of Catfish. There's no catfishing in this movie, I can promise you that. It's called New York Export Opus Jazz. It's an adaptation of Jerome Robbins' 1958 Ballet in Sneakers. And it is basically the sort of update that Jody Lee Lipes and Henry Joost took, which is to take this ballet, take the choreography by Jerome Robbins, and instead of doing it on a stage, they take it out into the streets of New York City. So you're watching dancers doing these classic moves, but they're doing them in a gymnasium or by, like, the McCarran Pool or...
on the High Line.
The High Line. The best sequence is this absolutely beautiful duet on the High Line, which is, for our non-New York listeners, the High Line is this sort of... it's been built up, but it's like this walkway on the west side.
It's old raised railway tracks.
Right. They sort of took these old raised railway tracks and made them into this sort of like reclamation project where you can just walk along. And it's really beautiful. And this was sort of done right before they kind of reopened it. You know, they refurbished it. So there's kind of weeds and it has this kind of beautiful decayed quality. It's at sunset. It's this beautiful duet. It's incredible. So it's only like an hour long, I think, the film. It is really, really wonderful. I really recommend it. That's New York Export Opus Jazz, available on Hulu Plus. And finally, time for an embarrassing confession, Allison. I have never seen the 1993 horror movie Leprechaun. I've never seen
it. Starring Jennifer Aniston?
I know. I've never even seen Leprechaun in the Hood. I've never even seen Leprechaun Back to the Hood or Back to the Hood. I'm not sure if it's duh or the.
In space?
Nothing. It's my deepest and darkest shame, Allison. All these years, I've hid it at the end of a rainbow beneath a pot of gold, hoping no one would ever find it. And now it's exposed for all the world to see. But the good news is, Allison, that I, like the rest of the world, can now watch Leprechaun on Netflix. And I plan to.
Well, you have to be ready for Leprechaun Origins.
That's right. Coming soon, starring, I think, one of the WWE wrestlers, right? I think it's a WWE wrestler named Hornswoggle. He's like his gimmick is he's like an Irish. He's a little person, and he's a wrestler, and his name is Hornswoggle, and now he's the new Leprechaun. I'm not making that up.
I believe you.
But you're right. I do need to prepare.
All right. Well, let's move on to two listener recommendations.
Okay. This first one is from Chris, and he writes, I remember once in the early days of the podcast hearing Matt recommend the movie For All Mankind from the Criterion Collection as both a visual and scientific marvel on Hulu Plus. And with that in mind, I'd also want to recommend the recent reboot of Cosmos, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson. So far, we've only seen 7 episodes in the current season, and at a little over the halfway point, this show has been a mix of awe-inspiring and mind-blowing, demonstrating scientific principles, theories, and history in an incredibly accessible way. The writing never talks down to the viewer, and it's also willing to explain many modern scientific ideas in a way that breaks it down step by step, making it easy to follow. The series is currently available to stream in high definition on Hulu Plus, but you can also catch it on Fox if you have a cable subscription, or on HitBliss if you are part of the Amazon beta. That's from Chris. That is Cosmos, the new version of Cosmos. I haven't seen any of it yet. Allison, have you been watching Cosmos?
I've watched some of it, and I've liked it, definitely.
Mm. It sounds great. Actually, it sounds really, really good. It's something I need to make time to at least watch. After Leprechaun... that's my plan.
Right,
Leprechaun 1.
Priorities.
Leprechaun in the Hood 2. Cosmos 3. Leprechaun Back to the Hood 4. That's the ranking right now. I think that makes sense.
I like it.
All right. My next recommendation, speaking of the WWE, this is from listener Primetime Paulie G. He says, hey, Allison and Matt, I just finished watching Warrior, the Ultimate Legend, an hour-long documentary released by the WWE last week on their new WWE Network. It was produced in about a week as a tribute to the Ultimate Warrior, the professional wrestler of the 80s and 90s, who died on April 8th, less than 24 hours after appearing on Monday Night Raw for the first time since 1996. In fact, the documentary not only covers his wrestling career and his well-documented legal disputes with the WWE, but also contains lots of backstage footage and interviews with Warrior. And it's extremely surreal since you're aware that this was the final weekend of his life, and that was just 2 weeks ago. If any of your listeners are or ever were wrestling fans at some point, I highly recommend both the documentary and the WWE Network, which has a lot of great content, including new documentaries on other wrestlers and all of their old pay-per-views. I watched these on a tablet, which was great because I was able to do a bunch of push-ups and planks while keeping my eyes on the screen. I know Warrior would be proud. Well done. That's impressive. Impressive work. Yeah, this is the movie is important to mention, but I think the WWE Network, it's kind of an impressive undertaking,
it
Allison.
It is. I was reading about it.
Yes, it's, I think, $10 a month, and you can watch all of their upcoming pay-per-views, like one a month, that you used to have to pay $60 a month for, and they have their entire back catalog of all their old pay-per-views. So for me, as a kid who did grow up watching wrestling, including The Ultimate Warrior, I was very sad to hear about his untimely death. He's a young guy. He was like 50-something.
Yeah.
Really, really sad after he had made this triumphant return to WrestleMania and Monday Night Raw. It's really a shame. But impressive that they have, you know, this whole network and also this kind of operation where in a week they can put together this tribute to him and put it on their network. And then I think they have a streaming component where you can watch what's airing on the network live. But then you can also at any point on demand watch their entire catalog, which is incredible. I mean, they're kind of ahead of the curve, really, from a lot
really
of networks.
Are,
and I think in 10 years, I think this is the model that a lot of networks are going to be following.
Yeah, I think that TV especially is still catching up to the idea of putting archives online. You know, the early days of television are kind of famous in general for people losing things
right.
that are considered now incredibly valuable.
Yeah, they used
footage.
To just reuse the tapes.
Yeah,
the master
throw them
tapes.
Away or not tape them.
They
at
would
all.
Tape over them.
Yes.
The way you would tape over a movie, like if you watch, you know, oh, I don't need to watch Airheads, and I'm going to retape over that.
Right.
They
Except
used
that was
to do
the only copy.
With the
I know.
Only copies they had.
I know, it's
Incredible.
Crazy. And so the fact that the WWE has all of these back archives and understands that they
Their
have
value yeah.
is certainly very forward thinking and impressive.
Yeah. So for the wrestling fans out there in the SVU audience, and I certainly would consider myself one of them going back to childhood, there you go. The WWE Network might want to look into that. And finally, before we get on to my my list pick, we did just want to give a mention here. We got a great email from Cameron in Australia. I don't know why I'm calling it great. He took us to task, Allison, for
our recent
episode, our last episode, which was our theme was sword fighting. He was very upset that we did not mention there can be only one sword fight movie, he says, and that movie is Highlander. This film has it all, he says. The brilliant premise, the completely mismatched accents, the kick-ass Queen soundtrack, and of course, the amazing sword fighting. Not to mention the fact that it was directed by Australian Russell Mulcahy, who cut his feature teeth on Razorback and went on to direct Ricochet and one of the Resident Evil sequels, all of which I assumed would be right in Matt's wheelhouse. There's your three films for your next episode's Listener's Choice poll right there, he says. I was going to rip up my Film Spotting SVU membership card then and there, but I've decided to give you another chance if you'll go up to the top of your building and record the next episode while trying to cut each other's heads off with broadswords.
I mean, we already did that before we started this podcast.
Yes.
So if only I'd known, we would have recorded it.
We did it, and then because we had to keep going, much like Highlander 2, The Quickening, we just ignored that had happened, and we just soldiered on. So our apologies to Cameron. Highlander is it's a fine sword fighting movie. It's very silly. I do kind of enjoy it. I think we did even look it up just now, right? It's streaming on Hulu.
Yes.
Hulu Plus. So we could have recommended it.
We apologize.
We just didn't. Yes. Film Spotting SVU regrets the error.
All right. Well, one film from your my list.
You gave me number 81, which this time was Breezy. Breezy. B-R-E-E-Z-Y. That's Clint Eastwood's third film as a director after Play Misty for Me and High Plains Drifter, one of his more obscure titles, actually. The plot description reads, free-spirited Breezy gets into serious trouble when she meets a man who tries to take advantage of her, giving her plenty of reason to get rooted, whatever that means. The stars are William Holden and Kay Lenz. I've heard great things about this movie from my friends who are Eastwood auteurists who really, really enjoy the Clint Eastwood experience. Allison's grimacing and shaking her head. She's not into the Clint Eastwood experience.
Well, certainly not the kind of the apologetics that have gone on sometimes.
Yes, there's been some of that, I suppose. And I'm not as big a Clint Eastwood fan as some of these colleagues. But nonetheless, I have added Breezy to my list. And so it's sitting way at the bottom there, down at number 81. So I haven't seen it yet, but I'm hoping at some point one of these days to get a look at it.
All right. Well, that brings us to our listener's choice section, in which we offer up three picks for you, the listener, to vote on for our main review in the next episode. And we have a mix here, but they're all mostly recent films.
Fairly recent. Yes. Apologies to Cameron. We're not doing the Russell Mulcahy trilogy this time. Maybe next
this time. Honestly, with availability, we'd have to check on it, but I would love that. That would be great.
That would be pretty impressive. But another time. This time, we're going to start off with this first option. It's available on Netflix. It's Insidious Chapter 2. This is not a very dark remake of Neil Simon's 1977 play Chapter 2. No, no. It is a sequel to the horror movie Insidious from 2010, directed by James Wan and written by Lee Whannell, the men who were also responsible for the Saw franchise, at least in its early phases. Insidious was their first haunted house movie. It had some notable twists. I found it very scary and effective. Allison, did you see Insidious?
I did, and I thought it was very scary.
Yeah, it was a good movie. I honestly don't know that much about the sequel. I've kind of avoided too many details. That's fine by me. I don't really want to know. What I know is Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne, who were in the first movie, are in this one. And it's directed by James Wan again, and it's written by Lee Whannell again. So the important people are back. And that's pretty much all I need to know. And I have this actually way up on my list. This one is up there in the top 5 or 10 for me because I've been meaning to check it out. So, yeah, this would be a strong one for me. I'd be very happy to watch this one. It's Insidious Chapter 2, streaming now on Netflix.
All right. Well, the next one would be a strong one for me. It is Joe, which is available for rent via the usual outlets. This is the most recent film from the recently fairly prolific David Gordon Green. This the film stars Nicolas Cage as Joe Ransom.
I play Joe.
Such a good name, Joe Ransom.
Joe Ransom.
Yeah. It reminds you of the type of film where, you know, it's called Sabotage, and then the main character will be called Mark Sabotage. anyway, Joe is an ex-con who ends up befriending and mentoring a teenager played by Ty Sheridan from the film Mud, most recently, who's great in that. And this film has been cited as a reminder that Nicolas Cage doesn't always have to be a scenery-chewing weirdo of an actor.
He can actually be
a really great
actor. But it's
kind
of fun when I am.
Exactly. Also, this film was the reason that Nicolas Cage and David Gordon Green did a talk at South by Southwest this year. You can find notes from it at a lot of different sites, but it's really interesting. Cage actually makes a pretty good case for himself.
Yes, he does.
Even though he cites The Wicker Man as his favorite performance of his.
As well he should.
Is something that I think some people might argue with him about. But that's for them to decide. But that is Joe. It's available for rent.
Yeah, that would be that's I haven't seen that one yet, and you know it's on the list also of movies I've gotta watch certainly before the end of the year. So I'll be very happy to watch that one as well. This last one I would be happy to watch also. I've already seen it, so I know I would enjoy seeing it again because I liked it the first time. It's called The Past. It's also available for rental on a variety of sites, including Amazon and iTunes. It's the latest film from Asghar Farhadi, who wrote and directed A Separation, which won the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar a few years ago. And this is his follow-up. It's a kind of a similar film. It's a domestic drama. And it stars Bernice Bejo from The Artist and Tahar Rahim from A Prophet. So you have some excellent actors. And it's about this very complex family. The Bernice Bejo character, she's this woman. She's essentially trying to divorce her husband so she can marry another man. But there are all of these intricacies. It's very complicated. And, you know, as the title suggests, there are these secrets from the past that come to light. And I saw this movie at the end of last year, and I thought it was very good. I think it kind of got buried. It just did.
I mean, you know, given that A Separation was, that was one of my favorite films that year. It's amazing that this kind of came out and then no one talked about it.
Yeah, I think it was a matter of, you know, it was similar to A Separation, but not quite as good. And I certainly wouldn't claim it was as good as A Separation, but you know, it was still really good. It's like saying, you know, like, oh, this Chipotle burrito isn't as good as my meal at, like, you know, like a Rick Bayless restaurant. I still really like the Chipotle burrito. It just wasn't, you know, the 5-star meal. You know what I mean? Like, it was still very satisfying. So you haven't seen this one.
I have not.
So for Allison, it would be the first time for me. I would happily watch it again. I thought it was an excellent film. That's The Past, and it's available for rent on Amazon, iTunes, and a bunch of other places.
All right. Well, which movie should we review in the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, April 28th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, at FilmSpottingSVU. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will be on Tuesday, May 6th.
Film Spotting SVU is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we've discussed on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer, and you can follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you, the SVU listeners. And don't forget to keep sending those listener recommendations to us at our email address, svu@filmspottingsvu.com. And for Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.